about the last year and a half, during the Green Sundays, I have been saying that one of the principal, if not the principal, foci of the Green Sundays is the nature of Christian discipleship, the cost of Christian discipleship. How do you and I put being disciples in our hands in our own time, the first part of the 21st century? But the Green Sundays are also a time in connection with that where you can do a little teaching, that there's a didactic quality to, or ought to be, to the preaching, because the readings deliver up to us subjects that lend themselves to acquainting ourselves once again with some of the deep things of Christian faith and belief. So I've also mentioned more than once that the way the lectionary is organized, the Sunday readings, boy, I have to tell you, I am so glad that I'm part of a liturgical church, and it isn't all up to me to pick. My text today is, I'd go nuts if I had to do that all the time, that we have a lectionary, and normally what happens is that the lectionary, the reading from the Hebrew Bible, from the Old Testament, and the reading from the gospel often connect thematically, and the second reading, which is usually one of the epistles, kind of poodles along on its own thematically. But it's always been my perverse desire to see if you can connect the second reading either to both of the first and the last, or to one of them. And so that's what I want to do today. I think the reading from Colossians, one of my favorite of the Pauline or Deutero-Pauline writings, more on that in a moment, has something to do with setting us up for the predisposition that we see manifested in the Samaritan in this famous parable. By the way, the parable of the Good Samaritan is one of those candidates for the religious literacy test. You know the book I've told you about by Prothero, who teaches at, I think, Boston College, and talks about the necessity for the people in our culture, all people, to have some species of religious literacy. And it used to be that you could take for granted that even non-believers had some vague idea of what the Good Samaritan meant, or what the prodigal son was, and how that might be applied to circumstances that may on the surface have no specifically religious content at all. Because in a few minutes I'm going to say, here we have seen over the centuries the transformation of a term that was once a term of opprobrium, Samaritan, to one that is positive and affirmative. It is good to be referred to as a Samaritan in one sense. In fact, we have a hospital over here called Good Samaritan Hospital. And when Jesus spoke this parable, the Samaritan was not a good Samaritan in the view of the thought world of his day, and certainly amongst his religious cohorts. But first let me talk about Colossians. Sounds a lot like galoshes always to me when you say Colossians. Colossians was written probably between 58 and 60 CE. And the reigning hypothesis amongst biblical or New Testament scholars is that this is Deutero-Pauline, which means that Paul didn't write it, and it was written by a disciple of Paul's, probably Epaphras. Well, who's the guy? I can't pronounce his name, because he was mentioned in it. He may have written it. Yeah, that's right. So it might be. Who cares? Well, there's a reason. And there's been about 7 tons of scholarship expended over this. If you want to think that Paul wrote it, it's perfectly fine. I don't think that it does any real harm. Although maybe it's important to know these things, because when we do, we begin to see, even embedded in the New Testament itself, the processes of development in people now saying, how do they make part of their own personal history
the faith that has been brought to them, even by the eyewitnesses or the original founders, and taken it to another level, or given it a greater species of fullness, which is entirely possible if we understand Colossians' Deuteropauline, that there represents some development within this epistle that perhaps Paul would not have focused on or emphasized. One of the things may be the importance of the baptismal covenant and its implications for Christian faith and life. In any case, we're in the introductory material here, and that's not usually too riveting, right? Grace and peace with you from the, you know. But there's something that's mentioned here that I believe is both an opportunity for a teaching moment and maybe a way of saying that there is a predicate amongst Christian people, even in the New Testament period, for seeing the kind of compassionate response on the part of the Samaritan that we see. What causes this? And remember, if we understand our chronology, the Pauline writings or Deuteropauline predate the Gospels. So there is a generation's worth of Christian practice operating among faithful people in these congregations before the writing of the Gospels. So if we date 58 to 60 Colossians and we date Mark, the earliest Gospel, let's be conservative and say 65, we already see that there's an up and running approach that's operating. So when a gospel writer speaks like Luke, 85 to 90, about the teaching of Jesus, he may be aware now of a little bit more of what's going on in Gentile Christianity. So, more on that another time. But here's what Paul talks about in Colossians and congratulates or affirms or gives thanks or blesses the Colossian congregation for, and that is that they have begun to express the theological virtues. That's what we call them later, but he calls them faith, hope, and love. And he said, you know, faith, hope, and love are the things that give you the energy, the ability, the capacity, the strength, and the stamina to meet the challenges and the opportunities that are in front of you as a Christian person, and just maybe the practice of compassion. So let me stop there and not go to the Good Samaritan yet and say something about the theological virtues, because they are important. You know, Christian people, even in the New Testament period, didn't all of a sudden say, well, now because of Jesus, I'm going to live as a moral and ethical person in a way that is completely new and has never been thought of before in terms of the way human beings interact and do stuff. To be sure, Christianity brought to the ethical and moral understanding of the ancient Near East certain ways of being and relating that represent developments and intensifications of the way in which people now had a stronger and greater moral sensibility. But it flowed out of a common life that was, by the way, primarily urban. City people are different than country people. I'm a town boy myself. So, you know, it's a different deal. Colossae wasn't a hick town. Paul wasn't writing letters to hick towns. He wasn't talking to hicks, to use a sort of semi-pejorative word. He was talking to urbanites, right? And urban people, in terms of living life and interacting with one another, have a way of understanding things that's different. So he's talking about faith, hope, and love. The Christian said, how should we ask? What do we appeal for being a moral and ethical person? And in that part of the world, they would have said, well, you know what? Plato and Aristotle gave us some ways of doing this. And they're called the virtues.
The cardinal virtues is what they ultimately were called. Cardinal means, cardo is the Latin word, the hinge on which all the other virtues depend. And they are prudence, justice, temperance, and fortitude. So people now believe that in the mighty works of Jesus Christ and in his preaching and teaching and works, they have seen words and works indistinguishable from the words and works of God. And they have said, we now have been made, we have now been enabled to live into the highest of our human potential. And what if we follow these cardinal virtues? Do we add to them by virtue of understanding the presence of Christ as part of who we are by virtue of our baptism? And three things bubble up: faith, hope, and love. And faith, hope, and love are called in the old catechism the infused virtues. They're the virtues you get through your baptism. They're virtues that come from God that you don't do anything about getting. They just come to you. Is it possible for somebody to reflect faith, hope, and love who hasn't been baptized? Of course. And by virtue of this, I suspect people have used that terminology to describe what they have seen played out in human interaction prior to the Christian experience. But for sure, we believe, as people of faith, hope, and love, we have seen it made manifest within the people of God in a special way. And so did the early people who wrote the biblical witness. So Paul, or the writer of Colossians, is saying faith, hope, and love is now going to enable you to live in a new way. Now, what's underneath all that, by the way, is that there's a controversy in Colossae. And maybe some new people have come in and said some things to them about, well, you may have been on the thought this is how you're supposed to operate in terms of this, but this is really how you're supposed to be an authentic Christian. And we have a new list of to-dos for you. Okay? So this epistle was addressed to the faithful in Colossae. Those who believe still that perhaps what they have received from Paul or his followers is the way to proceed, and to acknowledge that faith, hope, and love is important. So just hold that for a moment, because by the Gospels, faith, hope, and love is going to be an important way of understanding what is it inside each of us that helps us function in a spiritual and relational way that is healthier and life-giving. So in Luke, we have the parable of the Good Samaritan, which is unique to Luke, just like the prodigal son. Those two famous parables are only in Luke's gospel. And it's about a guy who gets beat up on the road. If you knew something of the geography and where the Samaritan parts of the ancient Near East were, and where the Jewish parts were, and how this all intermingled in some ways. I kind of like to think sometimes of the Samaritans as the Palestinians. That might be a fair way to talk about them. Father Cockrell's here, you can tell us that later, because that is maybe a way of seeing both geographically, but also in terms of how they're looked upon by many. So two fairly pious and important individuals within Jesus' community pass by this guy, go on the other side of the road, and a lot of stuff about why they would avoid that, why you would not do that and go near this person. And a person comes and helps this guy, treats his wounds, carries him back to a hotel or a place, pays for his lodging, and says that he'll come back and for all the things that he needs for him to convalesce. And Jesus tells everybody that this person was a Samaritan. When he came to that punchline, the jaws must have dropped. Because Samaritans and Jews hated one another for 100 years. Jews believed that the Samaritans were the inauthentic Jews. They're the ones left behind during the Babylonian captivity. They didn't go. And their religious cult developed Mount Gerizim as their holy site.
they have a different understanding of the books of the Hebrew Bible and whether, you know, all of that sort of business. And they were looked upon with opprobrium. And the Samaritans likewise looked on the Jews as being pretty stuck up and superior. So the very idea that a Samaritan would do something like this is amazing. And so the transformation of Samaritan as a term that is a good term is important, I think, in some ways. Because this particular Samaritan practice compassion. I got to thinking as I wrote this that we should say something about how the Samaritan responded and maybe understand the Samaritan as a kind of template for the way in which we ourselves practice compassion. We've been deeply influenced in this century, this I'm filing by title, and you may want to ask questions about it. One of the most pernicious words in the English vocabulary is empathy. And it didn't come into the English vocabulary until the 1920s. And it was a term used in German in the area of art criticism. Not the emotional and psychological interaction. Einführung was to live into. So everybody thinks it was good to, you know, what will we get sort of these Native American statements like, you must walk in another brave's moccasins for two moons to understand him. That he might have had bunions or something, I don't know. Right? All that stuff. I grew up on stuff like that. And what it doesn't focus on is the compassion and the sympathy that are much older English words and words that have, I think, more character. So when I was preparing this sermon, I looked up in a commentary a comment that I had forgotten about, written by a New Testament scholar named Carlson. And as it turned out, I remember that I'd actually met him. He's a Presbyterian minister, and he used to teach at the Andover Newton Seminary, one of the great Protestant seminaries in the East. And I married his son. I mean, I'm already married. I married his son in Sausalito. His son was a software developer who developed the program Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego? So he's not worrying about where his next square meal is coming from, I can assure you. And he assisted me in the wedding liturgy at Christ Church. It was nice to have him. And here's what he says. Maybe this will promote some conversation. Too often we let need motivate us as Christians. We see people in need, be it physical or spiritual, and so we respond. The problem with need as the motivation for our Christian practice is that the world will always produce more need than we can satisfy. When need becomes our fundamental motivation for Christian practice, ultimately we will end up feeling guilt-ridden, hopeless, bitter, or burned out because we as individuals and as the church can never meet nor solve all the needs of this world. Likewise, when need motivates us, we are treating others as objects rather than neighbors. Note well how the Good Samaritan shifts the focus away from need and away from neighbor as an object. Instead, the text holds up compassion as that which motivates practice, so that neighbor is defined as the one who enacts compassionate practice instead of the one who is in need. Thus, the motivation for our practice is grounded in the divine compassion poured out to us in Jesus. This is an unending storehouse of compassion that allows guilt-free, extravagant, selfless action for others. Neighbor is no longer that person out there who is in need. Now neighbor is I who have received compassion in Jesus Christ and who enacts compassionate practice for others.
If you think about that, it has something to do with the idea that you just give it. And that maybe you need to know, if you have the right kind of self-care, how much of this alleged neediness you're going to respond to. And how you just exercise the generous impulses that are present to us as human beings, we believe, partly due to faith, hope, and love as Christian people. You know, those of us in the health and professions constantly struggle at the institutional level and with volunteers and all kinds of things with the whole issue of worthiness. Is somebody worthy to receive the generosity or the assistance that they need? And so often there is a great temptation to have a fairly elaborate checklist of whether or not you qualify. Now, reason and common sense would suggest that there needs to be some of that. But at the same time, you and I, if we're thinking in old-fashioned Christian terms, are not going to be judged on the basis of how worthy the recipient of our generosity was, but that we gave it. And the business of whether somebody is not worthy really isn't ours. It's theirs. Right? And if through corrupt motive or dishonesty, they have been the recipient of our generosity, that's on them. Not on us. Some people may say, yeah, but you're a fool if you just squander all of your resources in that way. A lot of the great saints of God went ahead anyway and did it. So I'm not going to suggest in this sermon that we just throw out the window of making sure that we have some order and sensibility in the programmatic way in which we do this. But I am going to say that you and I always ought to err on the side of generosity. But that's sort of the default position for people who believe that they are animated and assisted by faith, hope, and love. So this week, think a little bit about faith, hope, and love, and give thanks for these infused virtues that are yours free, without regard to your merit. You get them, and they're part of who you are. Think also about neediness, and whether you have been run nuts trying to help a whole lot of needy people, and figure out how you can bring to bear the right kind of self-care to help you practice compassion rather than meeting somebody's need. If you'll do that, you will discover that you receive a new spiritual power and perhaps a clearer vision about what God wants you to do. Amen.